something beside me. A light to the kerosene. And the places aren't real anymore. And the faces don't say anything. In the silent light of the mind-blown sphere. It's a game.
Welcome to Devil's Chess Club. I'm Aaron Good. Today, my guest is Jefferson Morley, a Washington author and veteran journalist whose novelistic nonfiction books explore untold chapters in the history of the American nation. His books include Scorpion's Dance on Watergate, Our Man in Mexico, Winston Scott and the Hidden History of the CIA, and most importantly for today's discussion, The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. He also runs the excellent JFK Facts website, which I will link to in the show notes. This episode of Devil's Chess Club is available to everyone courtesy of Four Died Trying, the new documentary film series which explores the extraordinary lives and cataclysmic assassinations of JFK, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and RFK. There is now a Patreon page for Four Died Trying. It offers patrons a number of perks, including a new Four Died Trying podcast and access to the newest film, Chapter One, The World As It Was, which is also coming soon to other major streaming platforms. We are privileged today to have Jeff Morley with us. Jeff Morley, how are you doing?
I'm good. Good to be here, Aaron.
Well, I'm very happy that you agreed to come on because I think that you've done more on Angleton than just about anyone that I know. And some of the other things in this recently less redacted church committee testimony of James Angleton also deals with things like McCord, James McCord, and Watergate, which you also wrote a book on recently. So I think you're the perfect guy to be discussing these things. What do you make of this new Angleton testimony, which to me has a lot of pretty interesting material that we'd all sort of talked about before in different ways with Watergate and otherwise and the Israel connections. But I was really surprised to see this testimony and that it had gone kind of unnoticed, I guess, in the big haystack of declassified documents. So what's your take on this?
Well, when it first came out, I wrote a piece about some of the new things that had been unmasked from previous redacted versions of the Angleton testimony. Angleton talked to the church committee twice in June and September of 1975. And the June testimony was especially revealing because he talked a lot about the Israel account, which you went over in your presentation the other day, and the details that are coming out and the details that we can see are still redacted. I mean, obviously, this is a very, very sensitive subject. And this document has been pushed onto, it's listed in the CIA's transparency plan. So this is one of the documents that the CIA is asserting control over and saying, you know, we don't ever have to release what's still redacted in this document, or we will decide. And indeed, in the CIA transparency plan, they state specifically that even information that has been made available, even if the information is otherwise publicly available, they will still redact it in this testimony. They're claiming the right to do that. So highly sensitive and you know, bureaucratically, at least, related to the Kennedy assassination. These are JFK assassination related records officially. So it's a very interesting document. You know, Angleton was pretty candid in this setting. The church committee was just meeting and he was looking to justify himself. He felt he'd been wrongly fired 6 months before. And so he spoke very candidly about what he was doing, expecting that he would, you know, get approval from elected officials.
And David Talbot, what jumps out at you in this document, or what are some big takeaways for you?
Well, I think you and Jeff are really smart to look into this, because as I've said, I think Israel, the Israel connection, is one of the great unexplored, not thoroughly explored areas relating to the JFK assassination, and perhaps even to the Bobby Kennedy assassination. So I touched on it in my book, Devil's Chessboard. Jeff went much more into it, the connection between Angleton and Israel in his book about Angleton. So I think it's very important. Look, this subject, Kennedy in general, is the third rail for many journalists and scholars in this country. Still, 60 years after Dallas, it's ridiculous, as Jeff and Aaron, you point out. And I think this is the third rail within the third rail, the Israel connection, because I think the connection between the Israeli government over the years and the U.S. government over the years is fraught. And the events now in Gaza and the Netanyahu regime's policies have brought this to a head, this discussion. And I think it's very, very important.
Yeah. I'll tell you another thing, Aaron. I mean, when I read that testimony, and then, you know, I tell the story in The Ghost, I think it's important to understand the personal relationships that went into the Israeli account, because this accounts for how strong it was and how long it lasted. And Angleton started going to Israel in 1949 or 1950, and he pretty much went once a year for most of the rest of his life. And he was very close to a succession of leaders of the Israeli intelligence service, starting with Reuven Shiloach, who founded the Israeli intelligence service, and after a visit to the CIA, reorganized it and renamed it. That's when it became Mossad, and then came to Washington and made the original agreements with Harry Truman and Alan Dulles about a U.S.-Israeli relationship. And it was Angleton's friendships, first with Shiloach and then with his successors, a man named Isser Harel, and then in the 60s, probably the most important one, Meir Amit, chief of staff, of head of Mossad and chief of staff of IDF. You know, these were the foundational relationships that led to the strategic relationship between the United States and Israel. So Angleton's friendships were really important. And it wasn't just, you know, these were deep, long-standing personal relationships. And I went to Israel in 2015 and 2016 and interviewed Ephraim Halevi, who had been the director of the Mossad in the 90s and was very close to Angleton, and was very close to Rabin. He was kind of Rabin's executive assistant for a long time. That really accounts for the strength of this relationship as long as Angleton was in office and as long as Angleton controlled the Israel account, which he did until 1973 when it was taken away from him. But, you know, for 20 years, that, you know, the rest of the CIA was kind of fenced off from this relationship. They had no insight into the operations that Angleton or the Israelis were running. And as a result, this, the kind of Zionism was really baked into the CIA's DNA. Now, it's not a simple relationship because the CIA felt very badly burned by Pollard and really by the Jonathan Pollard case, and that the Israelis weren't trustworthy, and that created a real breach between the CIA and the Mossad. But the fundamentals of the strategic relationship were created by Angleton and his Israeli friends in the 50s and 60s.
And Aaron, let's remind your viewers, Angleton's connection to the Kennedy assassination, which Jeff and many others have looked into. Angleton, as head of counterintelligence for the CIA, was responsible for putting together the so-called legend of Lee Harvey Oswald, that he was communist, he was a Marxist sympathizer, he shot the president for probably ideological reasons. That's, we know now, largely a counterfeit story. It's a lie. Lee Harvey Oswald, a young ex-Marine, was probably inserted into the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War as a false defector. And then he was brought back to this country and closely surveilled by people close to the CIA and the FBI. And as he went about his business, he was probably a low-level intelligence agent, as his mother and Marina Oswald have asserted over the years. So I think this legend of Oswald as the lone assassin of President Kennedy was put together largely by James Angleton's shop at the CIA. And as many people like Jeff have documented, he also, by the way, shut down effectively, he participated in the CIA shutting down of the investigation, the CIA's legitimate investigation into the death of President Kennedy. He removed, had removed John Witten as a CIA informer, an agent rather, who was looking into the crime. And he replaced him. He was known as Scalzo, and I believe in the investigation later.
Just to add one point there, John Witten, who used the pseudonym John Celso, was considered in the agency the most skilled practitioner of the polygraph, and he had done counter-espionage investigations when the chief of West German intelligence defected in 1954, Otto John, and the CIA was trying to figure out, is this guy really a communist? What's the story? It was Witten who was put in charge of the investigation. So when Witten came forward after November 22nd and said, look, let's do a counter-espionage investigation. Where did this guy come from? Who did he associate with? He began to do that. And within a month, he was starting to gather a lot of material, and Helms and Angleton call him in and fire him on the spot precisely because they did not want an investigation.
Right. So that's important to note. Also, the tensions between the Kennedy administration and Israel during this time, and primarily over the transfer of the bomb, as Jeff wrote about in his book about Angleton, to Israel. That was an existential issue, a demand that Israel had, because Israel obviously wanted the nuclear bomb to dominate that region. And when President Kennedy refused to deliver that because he was against a nuclear proliferation, we understand that now. He took many steps to stop proliferation in those years, and he didn't want Israel to have the bomb. That's a big deal. As soon as he's removed from power, as soon as he's dead, his successor, Lyndon Johnson, gives Israel the bomb through the auspices probably of Angleton. So that's a big deal, and we should look into that, the tensions in the Kennedy administration with Israel, with Ben-Gurion and other leaders of Israel during that time.
Yeah, so Kennedy was pressing for on-site inspections of the Dimona facility, which the CIA had received reports from physicists who had visited the facility, who came back and delivered reports to the CIA and said, look, that's not just a research facility. That's a weapons facility. I can tell by what I see when I went there. And these warnings went to Angleton and were totally ignored. And Kennedy was pressing in the summer of 63 for on-site inspections. And, the result, it was taken very seriously. It was a crisis. The government fell in Israel in July 1963. Over exactly this issue, how were they going to handle relations with the United States and who could handle it best? So that was a key point, or there was a very real impasse between the US and Israel over the question of nuclear inspections in the summer of 1963. And once Kennedy was gone, all that pressure vanished.
Yeah, and in the document, they talk about the Schultz article, Jeff, they say in the galley of the Schultz article in Penthouse, and I didn't go back and try to track down the article to see if this was something that appeared just in the galley or was in the article that was published, But there's a quote that says, although the details of the Israeli nuclear enterprise are still top secret, it is known that in the wake of the 1956 Suez War, the Eisenhower administration resolved to provide Israel with all possible help in developing an atomic weapon. Now, they also point out that Shultz apparently had knowledge of Sidney Gottlieb and who he was, and mentions him as Sidney X as some way to show Angleton or impress upon him that he has this high-level source that is telling him about a very sensitive person who back then nobody knew who Sidney Gottlieb was. So right. Is it possible that what he is saying here, that after Suez, it was decided that Israel, that Eisenhower decided they would have the bomb. Is it possible that Eisenhower did that? Or is it also possible that this was some sort of Angleton thing that was not really the Eisenhower administration, but some sort of other, like some sort of other sop to Israel that perhaps Angleton or Dulles and Angleton would have tried to do to keep the Israelis on side? Because I see them as being, I think that there's a lot more in that Israeli account than we may, I think it may tie into the connection to some of the most sensitive things, especially those involving Lansky and the syndicate, because Paul Helliwell, you know, the guy that created Castle Bank and Sea Supply, which is an Air America, these things, he was also somebody who had, as I understand it, created some of the dummy corporations to like have the funding for Israeli and the war for independence and so on. And the Lansky just is a character that is over this whole area, this whole era, and this all of these mob connections and so on. They all seem to intersect at Angleton, and they seem always a step away from the issue of Israel. I mean, was there some sort of secret agreement reached in the 50s about the nukes that maybe under Eisenhower's administration, but not really approved by Eisenhower?
No, I didn't see that. I mean, the Israelis were very burned by Eisenhower in Suez when he refused to go along with the fait accompli. And it's in the debates over what to do about Suez where Bob Amory, this State Department official, goes to Eisenhower and says, you know, the Israelis are about to attack and you can listen to me or you can listen to this co-opted Israeli agent, Angleton. He says this to Angleton's face. And Amory was right. Angleton was spreading the story, maybe sincerely, but the false story that Israel was going to attack Jordan, not Israel was going to attack Egypt, a kind of misdirection. And so I don't know that that's when a decision was made. In 1956, that's when the NUMEC Corporation, the Nuclear Materials Corporation, gets going, refining uranium in Pennsylvania. And that's where the uranium for the Israeli bomb, eventually came from. But was there a decision by the Eisenhower administration? I always thought that it was more Angleton just controlling things passively as the person on the Israeli desk and just not passing on information to the rest of the government. So the rest of the government was really blind to what the Israelis were doing, or, you know, didn't have the most up-to-date information the way Angleton did.
And there's questions of what sort of dirt the Israelis and other people had on key figures of the U.S. establishment, like Alan Dulles and the you know, Rockefeller Standard Oil. I mean, I talked to Charlotte Dennett, and she had told me that they're working on a book that talks about how Rockefeller was basically blackmailed by Israeli people, Zionists, who had come across detailed information about, you know, Standard Oil, et cetera, their dealings with the Nazis. And I mean, they did have a lot of dealings with the Nazis. That factors into that whole DeMoor and Shultz debacle. That was Standard Oil. And that involved Alan Dulles as well. I mean, between the mob and the dealings with the Nazis, and then it gets into the highest circles of like Dulles and the Rockefellers, and then Angleton is there on the pretty loyal to the Israeli side, it seems, with the information of basically all the secrets, because he's in the most sensitive position in terms of he's the person who has to know what all the secrets are to like protect them. You know, I mean, is this something that might explain some of the way that the formerly sensible people like the Erebus, even the Erebus in the CIA and so on, they didn't really have this maximal Zionist idea at all. They believed the U.S. should try to have relations with Nasser and other people. What do we make of this?
Well, I think that, you know, when I was in Israel, I went to see the Israelis have not one, but two memorials to Angleton, one out in the country up in the hills above Jerusalem and one right outside the old city. And I think you have to think of Angleton as an Israeli spy within the U.S. government. And so he's a penetration agent. He's effectively acting on their behalf. I think he himself would have said that. John Haddon, his deputy, said he thoroughly believed that he was entitled to break the law on Israel's behalf because he liked them, he admired them. So I think if you look at him like that, then, you know, a lot does become possible. And these organized crime ties do go back to the 40s when Angleton was in Italy. And he met these crime figures and maintained relations with them for the rest of his career. So, you know, this goes a lot of different directions. It goes to the creation of the Israeli-American Strategic Alliance. The bomb is part of that. There's the part that goes to the Kennedy assassination, the investigation or lack thereof. And then also two key specific incidents like, you know, the Six-Day War, which was another thing where Angleton really and Helms sealed their relationship with the White House and really strengthened the Israeli. So the testimony that has come out, still redacted, really speaks to how central Angleton was to the creation of the Israeli-American Strategic Alliance.
Yeah, you know, Aaron, I think this connection is personal and political. Yes, Israel might have explosive information on the Rockefeller brothers, David and Nelson particularly, who were very close to the Dulles brothers, as I write in my book, both who was Secretary of State, and Allen, who was head of John Foster, was Secretary of State, and Allen was head of the CIA. So they might, as that's why I began my book detailing the close connection between the Dulles brothers and the Nazis before the war and during the war. And Allen is conveniently has himself assigned, of course, to Switzerland, where he met with key Nazi officials during the war and led to a separate surrender, essentially, with Nazi forces in Italy against FDR's wishes. You know, if FDR had lived, some people thought that he would have put the bankers, so-called, on trial, the Dulles brothers, for being traitors to the U.S. So yes, Israel probably did have intelligence on the Dulles brothers, very compromising, very damning information about them and the Rockefellers, what they did during the war. But I think Jeff is right. There's also a very key strategic reason for the U.S. to be allied with Israel. Israel essentially became the imperial cat's paw for the U.S. In the region, has monitored, has been a police state, has kept close watch on the Arabs, has the Arab countries and so forth. I think it served U.S. interests and vice versa. What we're looking at now today is the way Israel has affected U.S. policy and U.S. dark deeds, perhaps, even played a role, perhaps, in the Dallas operation, in the killing of President Kennedy, because he stood in the way, as we said, of transferring atomic weapon technology to Israel, which is hugely important to them. So I think we're just now, Jeff and others, beginning to look into this. I think there are a number of taboos on the subject, as we know. Every day we read about the poor protesters, how they're being rounded up, the National Guard being called, threatened by Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, and so forth. I mean, it's a really loaded topic, Israel. And you can be actually for Israel as I am, for the existence of Israel, and be anti-Zionist, be anti them in their imperial operations, their intelligence operations against the Netanyahu regime as I am. So I think it's very important to look into this, and I'm glad that we are finally.
Yeah.
And to me, the ideological part of it is useful for a certain kind of American national security crackpot like Angleton, because I think that there were those in the U.S. then and now still who were, I mean, there were the CIA Arabists, but there's also Eisenhower siding with them during Suez, and there's Kennedy. Like, the reason that you have to have a bully like Israel there is partly because you have Israel there as this thing that you have to protect all the time. I mean, many of the things that they do, you know, in the Cold War, especially post-Kennedy, they make sense if it, in terms of this maximalist idea of Israel, but they don't. You didn't necessarily have to do all of those things in the Middle East. Other people thought we could just make deals with these countries and have, you know, relations that way, not like just run this sort of total domination thing. But for the people like Angleton who really believe that the Soviet Union was this terrible, terrible threat and that the U.S. needed to be unassailable, I mean, I think in a way Angleton is kind of like the first, one of the first neocons, even though he's not thought of that way. He really seemed to believe that Israel needed to be this unassailable, you know, thing in the Middle East, and that the U.S. needed to destroy every potential threat that might arise to it. I mean, he was sort of, even though he doesn't articulate it, it's like the Wolfowitz doctrine is kind of in the implicitly in the way that he, you know, he's totally against detente, for example. I mean, yeah. this is where it aligns with the worst elements of the U.S. in terms of its foreign policy, the people that don't want to be able to negotiate, like, according to international law at any point ever, and just think that the U.S. should be the global dominator for all time. And I feel like he, perhaps because he had so much sensitive information, was able to move the U.S. towards this path. And when I look at this testimony, it seems that there's some pushback against that, even from people like John Tower, because his questions are very pointed, and they all kind of follow things that I have thought, and from reading people like Peter Del Scott, about these conflicts within the U.S. establishment. So this is, I think, key, is that Israel is part of this. They wanted unipolar America before we were even using that word.
Yeah, and I think I tell the story in The Ghost, and I think it's really crucial, is the run-up to the Six-Day War. So Nasser was determined to reestablish Arab nationalism and Arab rights in the Middle East. He asked the UN to remove the peacekeeping forces, which is seen as possible prelude to an attack. And so the Israelis are ready to go on the offensive, and they want to attack, but they have Suez on their mind. And they're afraid that if they attack without telling the U.S., that Johnson's going to hang them out to dry, just like Eisenhower did. And so what they do is they go to Angleton and they say, what does Johnson think? And Angleton connects the Israeli leadership in late May 1967 to all the decision makers, Walt Rostow, Helms, and others. What are the American intentions? What if we attack? What are you going to do? And Halevi told me that as a result of 2 weeks of intensive negotiations through the Angleton channel, he said, we knew that we had the green light, or at least a flexible light. And then a few days later, they attack and launch the attack. And so that was the service that Angleton did for the Israelis, was really to probe and give them inside information about how the Americans would react. And because the attack was a success, and because Helms's analytical people had said the war is going to be very short, they didn't say it was going to last a week, but they said the war would be very short. And that proved to be correct. Those two things, both what Angleton bringing the Israelis in and Helms's correct prediction about how long the war would last, this immensely boosted the prestige of the CIA and the White House. And that was the first time after that, after that happened, all of a sudden Dick Helms was invited to LBJ's weekly lunch. And so the CIA came into the inner circle, which Johnson had kept them out before. He did not trust them. After that, he trusted them. So that was a real turning point where the bond was forged. And it was Angleton who brought them in with Meyer Amit. And afterwards, Meyer Amit, the head of the Mossad, said, Angleton, he was the biggest Zionist of the lot. And that was, you know, they had their man in Washington.
Hey, Aaron, we should really talk a little about Jack Ruby. And Jack Ruby, of course, was given the assignment to silence, to kill Oswald for all time. Jack Ruby, as the Bobby Kennedy Sr. Found out, Attorney General, and his investigators after his brother was killed in Dallas, was connected to the mob and probably connected to Meyer Lansky operation, the Jewish mafia. Jack Ruby was told that he was serving Jewish interests, that it was good for the Jews to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. He'd be a hero. And I think he himself, as Lee Harvey Oswald famously said, later discovered he too was a patsy in this operation. So I think we have to look at Jack Ruby, who he was, why he silenced Oswald, what he was told, how he was serving Jewish interests as part of the larger operation. Because this touches on what you said earlier, Aaron, that this is possibly an organized crime hit also. I think, you know, Jack Ruby's affiliation should be explored.
Yeah. I think increasingly, like the person who's done the most work on Jack Ruby is Peter Dale Scott. And he writes about how Jack Ruby back in the, or in the, I think it's the 40s, he is present like in the room for this murder that takes place. And it's a key murder in allowing the Teamsters to the mob to take over the Teamsters pension fund. And he was at the time, like, part of the junk handlers union in Chicago. And he's with, you know, in the new book from Jim DiEugenio that he edited, the chapter on Ruby describes him as being with the Yiddish mafia at the time. But I see that as being generally like the syndicate is, you know, Lansky and Luciano, you know, for a time. But then later, those other people like Trafficante and McWillie under Trafficante, like they all seem to be subordinates of, you know, Lansky and the syndicate. And when Ruby is, so Ruby has these connections to this big event where the Teamsters, you know, the Teamsters get corrupted by the mafia and they take over their pension fund. So this ties in, this of course all ties into Hoffa, and it ties into the Castro plots that we get into. And Ruby was fingered by a witness who was the wife of a congressman, right? That happens pretty like after the assassination. And he may be, who knows what they told him about this, but he seems to have been involved in logistics of the operation because he was seen at Parkland Hospital, right? I mean, it's more than just he was there to silence Oswald right away. He was identified as helping to set up shooters or something on the day of the assassination. He was seen by Seth Cantor at Parkland Hospital. And then, of course, and he's at that press conference where they talk about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. And then, of course, he shoots Oswald, and then he's in jail, and he's talking about, you know, how this is going to lead, if it could lead to the deaths of, you know, so many Jewish people and so on. I mean, what it seems that he, that there is some connection to this, but of course we're never able to get more into it. And the Warren Commission, squashed all of that inquiry into investigation into Ruby, which has got to be explained.
Yeah.
I have another question for you, Jeff, and you might know this. In 1954, he makes an allusion to how he took over a special unit, Angleton does.
Yeah.
And and it's a strange series, or it's a strange section of the testimony, because they seem to be kind of mixed up the question of when the Israeli account was reestablished or the connection was reestablished. I assume that meant because there was some during the OSS days that Angleton kind of references earlier. But then he talks about this 1954 unit that he had. And is that an assassination unit? Because I've heard that he was in charge of some kind of assassination unit at some point. And then 1954 was the year that they had Operation Success, and they released that assassination manual, if you've ever seen that, from the CIA, that has all of those people that are supposed to be assassinated in Guatemala, but they're all redacted. But then the CIA says, oh, don't worry, we didn't assassinate them. So I'm sure they're telling the truth. But was Angleton in charge of an assassination unit in 1954? Because it actually seems like if there was somebody, it would be him, because he was there in counterintelligence, like he was the head of that.
So it's unclear from the testimony what he's referring to. There's a couple of relevant things. There was an assassination unit which was involved a man named Boris Pasch, and Howard Hunt was the first one to identify Boris Pasch as the as being on the assassination team. And I believe that that team originated in 1954. But I thought from the testimony that Angleton was talking about the origins of HT Lingual, which also started in 1955. And there was a Pentagon program to open mail of servicemen that was opening a couple hundred letters a year. And Angleton took that program away from the Pentagon, made it a CIA program, and expanded it vastly. So when in that portion of the testimony, I thought that he was talking about that was the special unit that he took over. But I couldn't really, like you, I couldn't really tell from the context. It's opaque. It's vague to say what he was referring to. Both those things were going on at that time. I guess you could just put it that way.
Right. Right. And the other, I mean, when I look back at this time period, there is, and Nixon is in there as well, and it seems to be significant what he's doing, but it and these questions deal with it as well. It seems as though the part of the U.S. government may have been, including people like Colby, and Nixon, you have to assume, were looking to deal with this kind of rogue mobbed up intelligence aspect of the government, because they do a number of things. They shut down Castle Bank, you know, the Helliwell Lansky CIA entity. You have Air America is exposed, and that's essentially shut down. It's exposed by people like Peter, and then Peter's work eventually finds its way into Al McCoy's hands generally, and then he writes another book that becomes sort of more famous. But it was really, you know, Peter sent all this stuff to Allen Ginsberg, and Ginsberg got Al McCoy onto this case. And Al McCoy seems to be getting really interesting special help from people like Ed Lansdale and Lucien Conin and DEA officers and so on to write The Politics of Heroin. And I don't know if you've heard this part of it, Jeff, but they delayed Peter's book. The War Conspiracy really was going to be the first book with the Air America stuff in it. And it was delayed for the maximum allowed by the contract that he signed with Bob's Merrill in Indianapolis. And it just so happened that the legal counsel for Bob's Merrill was William Harvey. So,
Harvey, he was the CIA, former CIA agent, head of the assassinations operation for the CIA.
Right. And I'll ask you about him in a minute to go more about Harvey. But the other thing that's in this testimony is they're being asked by people, you know, Tower and the other people about McCord, and they're saying, like, what was McCord doing? He was really good technically. Why did he make all these mistakes? Like, it seems that the people asking these questions are thinking along similar lines that people like, you know, Peter Del Scott, and then I'm sort of following on Peter's heels, have looked at in terms of like what sort of conflict Watergate represented. But I mean, to me, another part of this is that it makes me think that Angleton was maybe the person who was manipulating Watergate as well, because it's a very similar, I mean, McCord seems to be compromised in a way. And actually Angleton even alludes to that in this testimony. He says, yeah, I sent him on a couple of things, and in the other one, he did something that he shouldn't have done. And it's a very weird statement. And, you know, John Newman has said that McCord seems to have been compromised in some way. And I thought that was a strange statement. But now after reading this, I'm thinking, like, what? I think these people may have been on to, like, what Angleton was up to and were trying to sort of root out this corruption, but then they're not going to end those practices. Like the CIA is going to keep doing everything it does. They try to build other, like Bill Colby is involved with Nugan Hand, and Nugan Hand takes the Southeast Asian heroin and just routes it to Australia, for example. I mean, this is, I feel like there was a civil war here over the syndicate and its connections to over organized crime and its connections to the CIA and operations and all of this. It's just, it seems to tie into so many things in this time period.
Well, they were, you know, they were doing what they always do, which was relying on these, you know, non-agency assets to do what the agency does, which is move guns and money, you know, secretly. And, you know, those were always their partners, you know, because through them you would have plausible deniability. And if you did get caught, you could say, well, those were criminals and we didn't have anything to do with them. And so that model is set up definitely in this time. Angleton, you know, was he behind Watergate? You know, I spent a lot of time looking at that. There was a grand jury witness who said he saw Angleton in the old executive office building talking to Hunt. I was never able to confirm that, but he was close to McCord. McCord had done a very important job for the CIA in the early 60s. Three CIA guys were arrested in Cuba. They were wiretapping the Chinese embassy. The Cubans thought that they were suspicious Americans, but didn't necessarily know that they were CIA. And McCord was tasked with organizing the jailbreak. And so they got the blueprints for the jail in Havana, and they were going to insert a team and extract these guys from jail in Cuba. And McCord was in charge of that operation, and he had organized it, and they were ready to go. And then the deal to free the Bay of Pigs prisoners was consummated, and these guys were released, so they didn't have to do the prison break. But that's the kind of thing that McCord was doing for, you know, for the upper echelon, was, you know, those type of breaking and entering things, which fits in naturally with, you know, what he was doing in Watergate.
Yeah.
So look, Aaron, I think we should also say, repeat what Jess just said. I think the CIA and the national, it was basically what happened in Dallas was a national security operation. And I think that people like Dulles and others were key to that assassination and to the cover-up. And I think Israel might have played a role, as historically a number of assets, a number of organizations like organized crime and others we've alluded to played a role in the CIA's game plan and the national security operation general. But we don't know the extent to which Israel or organized, maybe we do know a lot about organized crime and drug running, how that's aided our national security interests and the CIA's operations and so forth. But we're just beginning, I think, to fully understand the role that Israel played now, because it has been a taboo subject among researchers in this field for so long. But I'm glad we are. But look, that doesn't take away the fact that America, the U.S., has its own interests too in the Middle East and throughout the world, and in Dallas as well. And I think they were primarily responsible for what has gone down. Israel played a role, certainly, but we can't pin this on Israel. We should pin it on Washington. And I think what Israel has done recently is a different story. And maybe the cat's paw is more the tail wagging the dog, so to speak. But when you look at Dallas, when you look at even the Ambassador Hotel, I think the main operators were CIA people who thought they had the national interest in mind. They confused their own interest with the national interest, but nonetheless, it was a U.S. national security operation in Dallas and probably in Los Angeles too, against Bobby Kennedy in 68.
Yeah.
I think that makes sense, because you look back at the overall, you know, cosmology that they designed with during World War II, and then they created it called for the U.S. to be the hegemon of global capitalism. And then they double down on this with the NSC 68, and that creates the military-industrial complex and permanent war economy, basically to resolve issues with the global economic balance and the flow of dollars, because both Europe and Japan were not really going to be able to earn dollars, and that if under the way things were going and when Marshall funding ran out. And so they had to create this war machine and this Cold War colossus, and it churns along through Eisenhower. Kennedy has some misgivings about it. He's especially concerned about the gold outflow, and he's telling people, I'm not going to put any troops into Vietnam because that'll explode the gold deficit, and I need to maintain the U.S. position. So he wanted to manage things more sensibly, but the other people didn't mind, you know, excessive military spending and then the U.S. losing gold outflow, because it was part of their plans for global domination. I mean, it's just it's not really an exaggeration to say that. And Kennedy comes along and is looking to change that. Everything that they had done was to have the U.S. in charge of global capitalism. I mean, and then Kennedy comes along and says he's going to change it. So I think his assassination was overdetermined, and that, you know, these CFR types, your corporate liberal people like Rockefellers, and then your more hardline people that get boosted by the war economy and so on, you know, the people that would go on to become the neocons. I think everybody was in agreement that what Kennedy was doing was just unacceptable. You can't have detente with the Soviet Union, and you can't have support for third world nationalism, and that they kill him. And it's so obvious to me that that's like the basic of what happened. Like, he was trying to change a policy that was rather insane, bent on world domination, abetted by murder all around the world. And then he dies. Is it really so mysterious as to who would have been the suspect? I mean, it's actually silly at this point, in my opinion. So, but then the Israel part of it is those more hardline elements do come to essentially take over the U.S. empire's foreign policy, especially with Reagan and the neocons. The only pushback was from H.W. Bush. And then by 2000, they're totally empowered. Until about 06, and then Brzezinski and some of these other people say, hey, we don't need to attack Iran, you know? So there's still that element of some sort of waspy, sensible imperialists. But the fact is that the neocon sort of hardline Angleton approach that evolves into what we think of as the Wolfowitz doctrine and so on, this has actually led to I think we're at the brink of the end of the U.S. empire because of these people. This is where it's all very relevant. This history is really relevant to me. And I feel like this Angleton business is like, I don't want to call it like a Rosetta Stone, but it's like, it gives you a window into all these episodes. And it makes you wonder how deeply rooted this kind of super global dominance mindset, which happens to be quite pro-Israel, how much this impacted a lot of these events of the in our political history since World War II.
Yeah, I think it's very important. I'm with David. I think, you know, whatever the Israeli connections to the assassination, and I think Angleton is the most important of those, it's still a matter of a faction moving within the U.S. government. They might have been assisted by the Israelis, but the Israelis weren't the intellectual authors of the crime. I would put it that way. You know, they might have helped, they might have wanted it, but the impulse came from within Kennedy's enemies in his own government. I do think, you know, you said, Aaron, was Angleton the first neocon? Yeah, I think there's I think there's something to that, because when he leaves, you know, he leads there's a kind of reform faction at the CIA. Stansfield Turner wants to purge the, you know, operations directorate. He thinks it's top heavy. It's not accomplishing anything. There's the problem with, you know, doing business with human rights abusers, and they're trying to clean that up. And Angleton's really part of the, you know, the reaction against that within the agency, the B team, to call into question what the rest of the agency and the State Department were concluding about the intentions of the Soviet Union. After his retirement in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, he's a bit of a sad figure, you know, writing sort of for the Washington Times, and you know, perceived as a bit of a crank. But that holdout position that he took, you know, actually came to be the dominant one, you know, with the rise of the neocons, first in Reagan and then coming back under Bush, too. So Angleton is a kind of seed of that maximalist position in U.S. foreign policy, and always assuming the worst about the enemy's intentions in order to justify a maximalist policy.
And I'm just struck that now you hear people talking more about the end of the U.S. empire and the end of, people are saying that the end of Israel could be, you know, on the horizon because of the way, and it's because of this insane hardline, this hardline current that just came to predominate in U.S. foreign policy. It's, I mean, it's the dialectic. It's so straightforwardly dialectical that it's amazing. Well,
what I'm struck with is the rapidity which Zionist was not a word that was really in the U.S. political discourse until very recently. And now it's a hot button issue. You know, has Elon Musk banned Zionist from Twitter? I mean, I know he talked about that as banned terms, but, you know, it's out there, and the Zionist project has never been in more trouble in public opinion or in the Congress than it is now. You know, you have soldiers of Israel like Chuck Schumer saying this alliance is not in our interest and we got to do something about it. And for once, we may dictate terms to the Israelis instead of the other way around. That's totally new. But it is because the maximalist position, which, you know, now we see in Gaza, justifying a brutal war on civilians, you know, it's too maximalist even for U.S. public opinion.
Yeah. Let me just add that a number of leaders, Aaron, as you pointed out, have tried to rein in the worst impulses of the U.S. and its allies. And starting with FDR, who saved the system from itself, we know now, during the Depression and the war. And Kennedy, JFK tried to do the same, as you were saying earlier, try to save the system from itself. I think Bobby Kennedy Jr., who I support, is also doing something similar. He's trying to save the system from itself. So there are those voices at high levels who try to do the right thing. Whether they can, I think, win is another question at this point. I think the U.S. is going down a very dark path right now and seems to be locked into it, as is Israel. So, you know, I have to say I'm very pessimistic at this point. It'll take a crisis, I think, unfortunately, because we all have children, all three of us, for this country finally to go on the right path. But I think as researchers, as historians, the three of us have documented how the U.S. again and again chose the wrong path and killed its way to victory. And you can't do that. You can't dominate the world anymore, as you say, Aaron. With that, I have to leave you, gentlemen, because I am very late for another meeting. But it was great to see you both.
Yeah. Likewise, David.
Yeah, thank you, David. I'm going to ask Jeff a few questions about William Harvey, and then we'll probably wrap this up. But David, always great to have you here. So we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Take care, David. So Bill Harvey.
Yeah, he is also in these documents, and it is his passages are fascinating to me because they're talking about Bill Harvey and the Cuban business, and Israel is involved as well. This was where I thought, gosh, John Tower and these other people, have they been like reading Peter Dale Scott or something? How are they, where are these questions coming from? Explain the relationship between Harvey and Angleton, because he is one of the more sinister figures of this era for sure.
Yeah. So Bill Harvey was a very smart guy from the University of Indiana. Indiana Law School, became an FBI agent, a bit of a boozer and a drunk, woke up in his car on the side of the road in Rock Creek Park one morning, waking up by the police, and J. Edgar Hoover got wind of this and fired him. in 1947. So he went across the river, or went across the street, and he joined the CIA as a counterintelligence officer. Extremely brilliant, capable man, photographic memory, and especially interested in Soviet spy networks in the United States, and becomes a counterintelligence officer. But because of his background from a state school in the Midwest, his brilliance didn't really matter in that culture of that early CIA. Nobody was going to displace the Ivy League guys from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. It just culturally, it couldn't happen. And so very smart outsiders like Bill Harvey or Wynn Scott could go very far in the agency, but they were never going to get to the top. And so Harvey recognized that, and he asked for an overseas position. And he went and became the head of the Berlin base in Germany and distinguished himself there. He dug this tunnel and wiretapped the Russians. Turned out to be not such a great thing because the Russians were onto it early on because they had their own spy. But he had this great reputation based on his performance in Germany. So when Castro takes over, they bring him back to Washington and they put him in charge of the assassination program, ZR Rifle, and they put him in charge of Task Force W, Cuban operations. So he's really the heavyweight. By this time, they're calling him America's James Bond, and he waddles into the Oval Office in 1962, packing his pistol. And they say, here's America's James Bond. And JFK looks at him and says, this fat guy is our James Bond? And they say, yeah, he's a hell of a secret operator. So he had that reputation, and he was entrusted with these super secret operations. And this is where his path crosses again with Angleton. Angleton liked him very much and really thought that he was an aggressive officer. They had worked on a plot to assassinate Nasser by poisoning him, by putting poison gas in the ventilation system of where he worked. And this was
Do you know what year that was? Was that under Eisenhower?
That was around the time of Suez. They were thinking of that, and they decided not to do it because it would have killed a lot of other people. But when the order comes down in the spring of 1960, yes, we want to assassinate Castro, Angleton's brought in on the case, and he and Harvey, you know, look for ways that they can assassinate Castro. So Angleton is brought in, especially after the Bay of Pigs, to tighten up security on the counterintelligence side, and has this, you know, role of running secret operations related to Cuba. And in the testimony, Angleton talks about he has an Israeli agent inside Cuba at that time. Now, we don't know who that agent was, but, you know, that was probably, I mean, they were looking to assassinate Castro. So if they had assets inside Cuba, they would have used them as part of assassination plotting. So Angleton was in on that, was a partner with Harvey in assassination plotting in Cuba in the 1960s. So this, you know, when we talk about the Castro assassination plots, we usually talk about organized crime. But on the CIA side, it's not just Harvey, it's also Angleton who's involved.
Right. And this, to me, the fact that he was saying that he put Harvey in contact, this is part from the testimony, but it says, mentioned Bill Harvey, who I had put in touch with the blank during the Cuban business. So with the, you know, Israeli asset, presumably. They're saying they put Harvey, you know, in Harvey was in touch with these people. Now, there's another part of it here. Earlier you mentioned you put Harvey in touch with the Israelis or Mossad during the Cuban business. We know about Harvey's activity. Was there a connection between him and the blank during the Cuban business, or what was the connection? So they're asking about, like, what was the deal with the Israeli angle during this time period? Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, what they're getting at here, because they're talking about the organized crime angles, it seems like they're trying to poke around or get at the relationship between Harvey and the Israeli connection and the Castro assassination plots and the mafia business, because they're talking about how Harvey was seen with Rosselli. They mentioned Rosselli, And this is, I mean, this raises the question of, like, was Israel involved with these Castro plots? And Harvey says no, but I don't believe Harvey in this. I don't think Harvey can be trusted on this particular issue. I mean, why would, if we know that the, you know, Harvey is working with syndicate figures, and that people like Lansky are known to have helped Israel, you know, in the become established. And then later he retires to Israel in the 70s. And there's this letter from Lansky in 1975 where he says Nixon sure tried to take over, didn't he? Didn't work out well for him. But it's like, you know, for Lansky to say that, you're thinking, like, I mean, in my mind, like, Nixon was going after some of those sort of Lansky CIA, apparently Mossad, possibly Mossad connected entities. And then Lansky's back there at the end, retired in Israel, being like, Nixon thought he could take over and he didn't. I mean, what do we make of Harvey and this connection to the Israeli account?
I mean, you know, we know Angleton had a person inside Cuba. We know that Harvey was part of that, and that they were working on assassinations at that time. You know, I don't know what to make of it. I mean, there could be a lot behind it. There might not be. What I think, though, is striking about what you're raising is that not only was Angleton close to the Israelis at this time, but he was also close to the organized crime figures. And John Witten, who I referred to before, chief of the Mexico desk in 1963, tells a story in his HSCA testimony where somebody wants to know, can they give up the banking information about organized crime interests in Panama? And Witten is told, don't go there. That's Angleton's turf. We can't touch that. And Witten thought that this was Angleton protecting his friends in the mafia. He practically says that in his testimony. So that nexus is very strong, you know. Whether the Israelis were involved in the Castro assassination plots, I mean, if they were, they might have been more successful, I guess.
I mean, this is really what Peter Del Scott spent decades trying to suss out, is like the organized crime role in this. And perhaps part of the reason that you have organized crime and the Teamsters and the syndicate having as much power as they do is because they have backing within the national security state more so than would have been recognized. I mean, if people like Angleton were having dealings with the mob, and the mob one of the big questions is, what's the relationship between Lansky and Mossad? And knowing how the U.S. has cozied up to organized crime entities in the past, and then you think about how the mentality in Israel is that they are under such existential threat that anything is justified, that I think seems to be, I mean, they even recruited Nazis like Skorzeny, Otto Skorzeny. They used him to assassinate an Egyptian scientist in 1962. And in that same month, a U.S. Air Force officer went to see him in Madrid and complain about Jack Kennedy and how he was giving everything away to the Soviets. I mean, this is like they would work with anyone. And so this aspect of it where they're talking about how there's Angleton and these assassination plots and Harvey and his mob connections, and the Israeli connection is there too. It just makes you, it makes me think that they were likely had a big role in managing the syndicate. And that might explain why Hoffa and Lansky were able to get away with as much as they did for so long. And all these other figures, I mean, this is a real dark quadrant of our history.
Yeah. I mean, Angleton's attitude was very instrumental. He protects Valerie Borghese, the leader of the Italian fascists. The Black Prince, and spirits him out of Milan when the partisans are going to come and string him up, just like they did Mussolini. And Angleton smuggles him out of Milan in a U.S. military uniform. He protects Eugene Dolman, another Nazi war criminal, really without pause or without compunction. These people could be useful to him in the future. And so he didn't care what they had done in the past. It just wasn't it didn't figure. The other thing I think it's important to remember is in the 50s and 60s, you know, J. Edgar Hoover didn't acknowledge the existence of organized crime, and there was no popular understanding. It wasn't until the summer of 1963 with the Joseph Valachi testimony that the idea that there was a mafia, you know, didn't exist in public opinion. So these guys felt much more impunity because this was just totally under the radar. Later on, it becomes much more embarrassing, and the U.S. government, you know, can't be seen, understands that it can't be seen as cooperating with these organized crime entities. But before the mid-1960s, they could cut those kind of deals privately without, you know, without fear of bad publicity because there was no publicity.
Yes, this is, I mean, and even when it does become, it talked, discussed more, it is this kind of Italian, it's presented as an Italian thing when it was bigger than that. It was a multi-ethnic thing, but, you know, with somebody like Lansky at the top, I mean, and Hoffa and the Teamsters were, those drug trafficking networks were bigger than just these various Italian bosses. Like, it was a bigger,
right, and because it was an instrumental relationship, you know, the CIA had the same relationship with drug traffickers in the 80s, you know, who would take guns to the Contras and then have empty planes that they had licensed to put their drugs to bring back to the United States. The exact same relationship. Yeah, and it had nothing to do with the Italian mafia. It was these crime syndicates were useful, you know, for smuggling. And so the CIA relied on them.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it's just, and they do this in the, it becomes even more internationalized in the 90s and 2000s when the, at the end of the Soviet Union, it seems like these organized crime entities are involved in, I mean, Kosovo, for example, and Chechnya, those are very drug corrupted conflicts. There's an Azerbaijan coup in like 1991 that I don't think Bush was behind, and I think it could have been a British Mossad type thing. It just goes on this way, and it's been a part of the U.S. empire to use organized crime. What is organized crime? These guys aren't really any different than John Rockefeller when it comes down to it. They're totally ruthless, will do anything to make a buck, and will wipe out their competition in any way that they can get away with doing it. I mean, they're the ultimate Americans, you know, pretty much.
Well, organized crime is doing the same thing the CIA does, which is move guns and money under false identities. I mean, it's the exact same business. So, of course, you turn to those people. If your mentality is, you know, it doesn't make any difference, and the consequences, a cocaine glut in America, you know, that was of no interest or concern to the CIA. They didn't care that working with these traffickers resulted in huge amounts of cocaine entering America. That wasn't a factor. They were useful in, you know, getting guns down to the Contras. And if they want, you know, if the price of that was that they brought drugs back to the United States, well, you know, that's, we got the deal done, you know, and that was the attitude of Jack Devine and other people, you know, leaders of the clandestine service. And they did it in Central America in the 80s. And then they moved on to Afghanistan, and the same types of deals were cut with the same types of traffickers. And it wasn't until the Taliban came in that the big drug traffickers in Afghanistan who were aligned with the United States were put out of business.
Right. And then when we went in 2001, they actually sprang some of these guys. They recruited one guy who'd retired to France, who'd been a heroin lord in the 80s. And they said, you need to go. We need you. Your services are required. And then he sprang another high level drug dealer from jail as well. And they helped to reestablish the heroin traffic with the apparent, you know, thumbs up from the CIA. There's going to be no investigations of this because these things are too big. So this is kind of what we're used to, especially if we study the JFK assassination. Here, as we wrap up, why don't you tell us where people can follow your work and what else you're working on right now related to the case? Because you're one of the top people looking at the JFK case for many years now.
Well, so I write about new developments in the JFK assassination on my Substack, JFK Facts, which is a subscription newsletter. You can subscribe for free or a small price. And, you know, through there, we're really focusing on new information. We're not chewing over what's been known, but trying to put new information in the context of the old, weed out the bad information. And you know, we're making progress there. So that's kind of my daily journalism. And then, you know, for the deeper background of my book, my three CIA books really tell the story of the men who, three of the men who made the CIA, James Angleton, and my book, The Ghost, talks a lot about how the relationship with the Israelis was established. Our man in Mexico, about Wynne Scott, the station chief in Mexico, is about the formative events of US policy in Latin America and in Mexico. And then Scorpion's Dance is about the relationship between Richard Helms and Richard Nixon, which culminates in the Watergate scandal and the revelations of the 1970s, and kind of delivers us into the more modern era of the CIA. So I always felt that you couldn't understand the assassination of President Kennedy if you didn't understand the context, the intelligence context in which it took place. And all three of the men in my books, Angleton, Scott, and Helms, are all deeply involved in the surveillance of Oswald, the events of November 22nd, the subsequent investigation and cover-up. So they're not books about the assassination per se, but they show you the milieu and how these top people responded to the assassination. And when you see what they did, it's very clear that, you know, their intention was to make sure that nobody could figure out what had happened. Their own level of complicity in what happened, a little harder to judge. Angleton's certainly the most centrally involved. I think Wynne Scott might have been more caught by surprise, didn't know what was going on. And I think Helms was more passively letting Angleton do what he wanted to do and give himself plausible deniability. So the historical background of the CIA to the JFK assassination and to the, you know, contemporary issues like drug trafficking, Israel, that's all begins in the real history of the CIA. That's what I've tried to bring to the table.
Well, I recommend those books and your Substack as well. And I thank you very much, Jeff, for talking with us today.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks to Dana Chavaria for producing this episode, and thank you for tuning in. Special thanks to Four Died Trying for supporting the Devil's Chess Club. Visit fourdiedtrying.com for details. Please do subscribe to the American Exception podcast on Patreon for first access to all Devil's Chess Club episodes and for all new and past episodes of the American Exception podcast. I also recommend Jeff Morley's excellent JFK Facts website. Check the show notes for a link to JFK Facts if you want some of the best reporting and research on the JFK case. I wish I could definitively say that we understand what James Angleton was up to for all those years that he was running counterintelligence. He used state secrecy to obscure how he used the Israelis, the mob, and co-opted journalists to play his spy games. Decades have passed, and we are still trying to sort out his moves on the devil's chessboard.